Appreciate you so much for joining Wintrust Business Lunch with me, Jisoo Yee. Let's get down to business. We've got a lot to talk about, especially with Terry Savage, who is a favorite of the Wintrust Business Lunch. So I'm going to go ahead and give you the number here. It's 312-981-7200. I always feel so bad when the calls come in at the end of Terry's segment and then she's gone. So go ahead and text and call in now, 312-981-7200, to ask Terry Savage, who is our personal finance, economy, and markets expert, about your money and finance questions. Hi, Terry. How are you?
Good to be with you, G. Love Wednesdays.
You make Hump Day extra happy, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's talk about what's moving the markets right now.
Money, 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 money. Money's moving the markets, and there's a flood of money around the world. Not only the European central banks, the Fed says it's going to make sure there's plenty of money, and China is pouring money into its economy and its markets to stabilize things over there. So where's it all going? Into new highs in the Dow and the S&P 500.
And it seems that people are shaking off any coronavirus fears.
So far, you know, if it's not happening here, I remember in the old days when I traded on the options exchange at the foot of the Board of Trade, and the joke on the trading floor of the Board of Trade was that whenever it rained, grain prices moved, even if it's just raining on LaSalle Street and not in Iowa where they grow the grain. So it's kind of that kind of feeling. As long as the coronavirus isn't causing serious problems in the U.S., there's kind of an unwillingness to believe we're going to be touched. That may or may not be true. Not only touched in terms of us having citizens getting the virus, but in terms of companies that can't get stuff in from China because they're quarantining all the workers who all went home for this big New Year's holiday, and they can't get back to reopen the factories. So we'll see. Nobody has a good handle on that yet.
Well, Terry, we heard Steve Bertrand mention in his newscast that household debt jumps the most in 12 years, according to the Federal Reserve. Also, there was an article about how nearly one in three American workers, and this is even for folks that make above $100,000 a year, so nearly one in three American workers run out of money before payday.
You know, this is something I've been talking about an extra lot in the last 6 or 8 weeks since my new book came out, the new edition of The Savage Truth on Money. I've been speaking at conferences. I was just at the Money Show in Orlando. Those are a very high level of people who go to these conferences. And I was saying to them, you know, everybody out here wants to tell you what stocks to buy, what funds, what annuities, what deals to get. Could you just take a look at the ocean you're floating your boat on? Because it's an ocean of debt. And I've been using those figures about household debt. It's hard to remember because it's 11 years ago when everybody said, oh, my goodness, I'll never do this again. I will never get buried in debt. I simply can't live like this. People lost jobs and couldn't pay their bills. People lost their homes. And here we are, right back up there, higher than we were in 2008, both household debt and mortgage debt. Now, part of it, the economy is growing, of course, but part of it is people not remembering the lessons, and especially this latest report from the New York Fed says younger people are showing a higher and higher rate of delinquency. They, of course, don't remember what it was like 11 years ago.
Terry, you have a completely appropriate article that's just out on your website. Also, you have a weekly column that's syndicated by the Tribune Content Agency, and it's about online budgeting apps. So I suggest that everybody go and read this article because that might help folks not get into debt is if they create a budget.
Well, you know, online technology for managing your money has been around for 25 years now, so ever since Quicken started. Quicken is that program which has grown over the years. It sits on your desktop securely and allows you to sort out all your spending and put it in categories and instantly make charts and predict where things are going. A few years later, along came Mint, which was a free app paid for by messages to let you know that you could get a cheaper credit card or refi your mortgage, but it resides on your cell phone. And now Quicken and the company Intuit that started it have parted ways. Quicken is now a separate company. It is a subscription model. That is, you subscribe every year and it tracks all your finances on your desktop. And they have launched into the new world a completely new app called Simplify. And whether you're out there going, I would never manage my money on my smartphone, I'm scared of it, at least if you read this column, it's what goes up on my website every week is my syndicated column, so it goes around the country. And if you just want to say something clever to your 20-something children or grandchildren even, why don't you just read this column about Simplify? It's an app. It does cost $3.99, but you aren't bombarded with advertising.
Awesome
and
advice,
it's a new
Terry.
Way the younger generation wants to manage its money and categorize its spending.
Great, and that's on terrysavage.com. We're going to be taking callers for Terry. Wintrust Business Lunch, G here, joined by personal finance expert Terry Savage. Terry, we're going to take a caller. This is Dave. Hi, Dave. You have a question about retirement. Go ahead and ask Terry.
Yes, thanks, Terry. Hi, Terry. I'm 55. I plan on retiring next year at 56. I have a little over $600,000 in my 401k. I'll get a pension and Social Security supplement until I'm 65, and then I would start collecting Social Security. I have no credit card debt. I guess one of my main questions is, should I get out of like the high-risk market that I'm in now, and do you think it would be feasible for me to retire? I have no credit card debt at all.
Are you married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
I have one. He's in his last year of college that I had paid for.
And he has no college debt?
No, it's we paid as he went along.
You think you'd ever have grandchildren?
Probably. I would hope so. Yeah.
I want you to look down the road. I'll give you a great website, Living2100, LIVINGTO, and then the number 100.com. Take the quiz there. I bet you're going to find out, since you're obviously so smart and have been done such a good job saving and so forth, you're going to live well into your 90s. So at 55 to 95, let's just say, is 40 years. And without doing any kind of a financial plan for you, which is something you need to do, and I'll tell you how to go about doing that, you have 40 years and $600,000 in a 401k, number one, or whatever it is, retirement plan, is not, I could tell you, not going to do it. And in the last 40 years, or maybe 45, close to 50 years of my career in the financial markets, I have seen four stock market declines that averaged over 48%. I saw it in 72, 73. I saw it in 87, a quick one. I saw it in 1999, 2000, and 2008, 2009. So if, in fact, you were just in the S&P 500 stock index in your retirement plan and the market went down 30 or 40%, I bet you wouldn't feel so great about retiring. So long story short, 55 is too early. God bless you. You can't even think about taking Social Security until your full retirement age, which will be 67 or maybe even more. And you'd have to be investing very aggressively, which exposes you to loss. So I love the idea of retiring. You might want to retire from your job, but you don't want to start taking any retirement benefits early, and you should try and bridge that, not with money out of your retirement plan, but with other income that you could earn. Go to WealthRamp.com, find a certified financial planner who's a fiduciary, WealthRamp.com, go through their quiz, and let someone else line it up for you. But I can tell you without question that you're going to have a very uncomfortable retirement if you start doing that soon.
Thanks, Dave, for your question. And Terry, I had a feeling that that was going to be your answer. I kind of have a...
Yeah, we'd all like to do that,
right.
But, you know.
I kind of have a follow-up question. You were asking about the next generation, and this is a text question from the 260. Should a person title their brokerage accounts in the name of their living trust, or is it better to just name the beneficiary as transferable upon death? And my concern is which option is more certain way to avoid probate, the process and the cost.
Well, wait. If you rename the account, your brokerage account, let's just say it's at Merrill Lynch or Schwab, wherever it is, as a John Smith trustee for the John Smith Revocable Living Trust, there will be no probate, there will be no delays, and at death, your successor trustee, who you named in the trust documents, will step in. And if it was a retirement account, there'll be certain distributions and rules and so forth. But the most important thing is, what if you don't die, but God forbid you have a stroke? And you cannot make decisions, can't speak. I mean, that happened to my grandfather. I remember that happening. In a revocable living trust, your successor trustee can take over and act sensibly on your behalf without going to court and getting a power of attorney to do that. So I always recommend that brokerage accounts, not retirement accounts, but brokerage accounts be named in your revocable living trust. If it's a 401k, you want to name a beneficiary because that beneficiary can still stretch out the account after you die for another 10 years. So that's the difference.
A follow-up question is, should individual shares of stock be transferred under the name of the trust? It's under my name and the value is significant.
Yeah, there will be no tax implications. So let's say you bought Amazon 20 years ago at whatever it was, $10 a share, and it's in your name, John Smith, or even in a joint account, okay, because the joint account party's hands would be tied if you can't act. So if you've created a revocable living trust and you actually have the certificates, most people don't have them now, you contact the transfer agent. It is not a taxable event. It doesn't change your cost basis, doesn't incur capital gains taxes. They'll require copies of the trust document pages, not the whole thing, but the pages that set up the revocable living trust and have those shares transferred into the name of your revocable living trust. Estate taxes don't start till you're over $11 million, so we're not worried about estate taxes. And the day you die, let's say you bought Amazon at $20 a share and it's $700 when you die, your heirs will inherit that with a cost basis of the price on the date of death, and that holds true whether it's in your name or in the revocable living trust.
Okay, Terry, let's talk to Charisse. Charisse is on the phone. She has a question because her daughter wants to buy a house. Hi, Charisse.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call, Terry. So my daughter's 27 years old. She's got her master's. She's working as a occupational therapist. She's been saving her money, and she's got about 5% put down. It's a hot market in St. Paul. And I thought, well, I'm going to just ask you if you have any good book recommendations for a young woman buying her first home. That's pretty basic.
Okay. When you said St. Paul, did you say Minneapolis? You mean in Minnesota?
Yes.
Okay. So the first thing you want to do is look on your state's website and see if they have a state first-time home buyer program, because that might be something where she could get a low rate and put down only 5%. The second thing she needs to do is say, great, I'm going to put all this money into the house, but then what? What might I need? A new water heater, a new roof, a new this, a new that. So she needs to have more money set aside, not only for taxes and insurance, but for repairs. I have nothing against young people buying homes. You don't want to chase the price right now. Mortgage rates are very low. But she needs to do a whole budget. And, you know, one of the places you could get that done is if she calls 800-388-2227. I'll give it again. That's the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Maybe she doesn't want to go to mom and have mom tell her all these things, or even me tell her all these things, that home ownership requires a lot of liquidity for things that could go wrong, or at least a roommate that'll help her pay her mortgage, something like that. She can get independent credit counseling. It's not just for people who are buried in debt. National Foundation for Credit Counseling, 800-388-2227.
Thanks, Terry. And thanks, Charisse, for that call. Terry, of course, a book that you should always recommend is The Savage Truth on Money, which is fantastic for everybody starting out to read. You can also find resources and ask Terry your questions directly on her website, terrysavage.com. And you can read her weekly column syndicated by the Tribune Content Agency as well on her website. Thanks, Terry, so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Love it, G. Always too short. Thanks.
I know. Always. Okay. We'll see you next week.
Absolutely.
A lot more coming up on WGN Radio. G here with the Wintrust Business Lunch, joined now by Sylvia Ann Hewlett is joining me. She's an economist and a consultant. Also, she has authored 16 books. Welcome, Sylvia. Thanks so much for being with us. Your latest book is called Me Too in the Corporate World, Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. What available statistics surprised you the most on workplace harassment?
Well, Gia, as you know, there's all kinds of new data in this book and all kinds of hidden voices. So if you look at the data, which I actually put in the field with the University of Chicago, so, you know, shout out there.
Yes.
One thing that is quite clear is that we've been very aware of one kind of sexual harassment and assault over the last 2 years.
And what type was that?
That is the older, more senior man and the younger, oftentimes white woman. And in fact, that is a big part of the problem. You know, 34% of women are sexually harassed at work, and 7% of them are sexually assaulted. And in many cases, over 80%, it is an older man that is the predator. But what I see out there in this data is that 13% of men also experienced harassment. And just think of that. Amongst black men, right, 26% of them experience sexual harassment at work.
That is a story that you don't hear of often.
Yes. And I find, again, when I go look at the qualitative work I did, only 3% of them ever report. They fear ridicule, right? They are afraid of becoming their office joke, but they also fear retaliation. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the military, it's the same story, but in corporate America, this is happening. Another surprising figure is that 42% of gay women experience harassment. And again, these individuals do not report.
What I love about your book is we've heard a lot about the Me Too movement, but you also talk about, as an economist, the financial impact that happens with corporations and companies because of workplace harassment.
I do. The reason I stress it, and I do really crunch those numbers, is that it's driving action. Just think of it. You know, Nike, Uber, CBS, you can shave about 10% off the worth of your brand overnight if you have a scandal erupt at the top of the house. And at Nike, they actually lost 11 of their top executives, including the heir apparent. The other thing that happens, of course, is that there is enormous costs associated with lawsuits and settlement. Google, I think, has paid out about $350 million. Michigan State University, it's up to $1 billion in terms of the legal liabilities of all those suits from the athletic programs abuses. So you can get into real money very quickly. And what I find when I go around talking to chief risk officers at places like Citigroup and IBM is that newly it's seen as a strategic risk for companies. It's not just something that they can absorb easily, right? And so they are super committed these days to trying to tamp down the incidence of sexual harassment and drive more inclusive workplaces.
So the norms are shifting in how we do business. But what are some of the solutions that you offered specifically for companies and corporations?
I have two sets of top picks. And again, I've been rounding up the stuff that is working. I have 10 kind of tactics for individual managers. Some of them are obvious. You know, you've got to respect people's personal space. You don't meet your team members, you know, over drinks late at night in a bar. It's kind of obvious, but, you know, people still need to be reminded. But there's also a bunch of things you need to continue to do. For instance, you should not let go of mentoring and sponsoring fantastically able young women.
Well, Sylvia, talk about that, because you've written two books about the sponsor effect.
Yes.
And you say mentoring isn't enough. You should sponsor someone.
Right.
And what does that mean?
To have a senior person actively advocating for you, using up political capital on your behalf because they see you as being very valuable to the company, right? That is sponsorship. It's not just friendly advice. And if you have a sponsor, you're 20% more likely to get to the next rung of the ladder, you see. And this is enormously important in terms of women getting from the middle to the top of the house.
I would say that's very important for women.
Fantastically important. And the problem with all of these scandals is a lot of good men are heading for the hills. They're avoiding, sponsoring, avoiding mentoring. And I say, look, there's a very clear way in which you can do this safely. And I talk in particular about being very boisterous and public and noisy in terms of why the heck you're really advocating for this younger person of a different gender. Share her resume. Right? Have her present to the team, introduce her to clients, make everyone very aware of the fact that she's fabulously well qualified and super valuable. That prevents it. Seeing as, you know, something, you know, that is illicit or, you know, behind closed doors. So it's the boisterous public showcasing of the qualifications of the young talent. And of course, all of us need gender smarts at the top. The biggest growing market in the world, the most, you know, strongest emerging market isn't China. It's women. And this is the burgeoning market of our time.
And women are usually the ones making household buying decisions in the home.
Absolutely.
And you recommend a zero tolerance policy in terms of dealing with any type of workplace harassment inside of a corporation.
Absolutely. But really, due process is important. Very important.
There can be false accusations and the entire, both sides of the story need to be heard.
And I have a clear-cut set of guidelines because you need an external investigator, right? There is a difference between the Al Frankens and, you know, Harvey Weinsteins of this world. And I think that we need increasingly to insist on due process so that we limit the backlash that is clearly out there right now.
Speaking with economist and consultant Sylvia Ann Hewlett, talking about her new book, Me Too in the Corporate World, Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. Sylvia, who did you write this book for? Is it mainly for managers and the C-suite, or is it for employees?
I think it's for all of us. For me, although I have been in the talent field for a long time, it was an enormous eye-opener to realize just how vulnerable and how scared so many people are in terms of even talking about what's happening to them. And of course, too many people are leaving and languishing in the workplace as a result of this. So there's enormous waste, enormous cost.
Well, it's a great read. Thank you so much, Sylvia, for being with us. Safe travels, beating the snowstorm as you travel to O'Hare. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
G. A lot more coming up on WGN Radio. Happy Hump Day, Winter's Business Lunch. G here. Yesterday, the Federal Trade Commission announced that it would review the past decade of takeovers by tech giants, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Microsoft. But they're not only going to just review the large takeovers, the large deals, but also the hundreds of smaller ones that didn't even trigger automatic antitrust reviews. Joining us is Will Reinhart. He's the Senior Research Fellow for the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University, who's going to help us break this story down. Hi, Will.
Hey, how you doing, G?
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me on, by the way.
Oh, thanks for being with us. So why does this matter?
Yeah, I mean, this really is an extension of an ongoing investigation by the FTC that really started at the end of, the beginning of last year. So I think what it really shows is that the FTC is committed to this investigation and to learning more about these mergers and acquisitions. I think, you know, most of us who are in this policy community are encouraging the FTC to take a look at these things. But at the same time, I think that there's also this hesitancy and this worry that perhaps the FTC in looking at some of these smaller cases are really kind of, you know, missing the important thing that's going on here, which is that small companies get acquired by large companies because, you know, they need resources, they've got talented staff, and they want to take their technology to the next level and integrate it into national companies. And there's very clear pro-innovation effects from many of these mergers. So I think what we're going to see out of the FTC is really a review of that and a better understanding of that kind of ecosystem.
How far are they going to go back, and how small of these deals are they going to look at? That's going to be a lot of deals, a lot of paperwork, a lot of time, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the typically when the FTC, there's this kind of pre-merger is an automatic review process, which starts right now at about $94 million. If your company is worth about $94 million, then it automatically goes through review. They're looking through effectively these four companies that have been really singled out. So it's, you know, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook, from what I've heard. And those are the four companies that are being investigated by both the FTC and the Department of Justice. But it looks like they're going to go through effectively, from my understanding, something like 10 years of these mergers, or, you know, in some cases, since the beginning of Facebook or the beginning beginning of Google. 400, I heard something like 400 or 500 mergers and acquisitions they're going to review. And it'll be, my assumption is that it's going to be a pretty thorough look at some of these past cases. And I think what they're probably going to find is that in a very large, vast majority of them, and that, you know, consumers have benefited quite massively.
Of course, they're going to review some of the big mega deals that consumers, regular folks, will know about, like Amazon,
oh, yeah,
and Whole Foods, and Google and Nest, Facebook and WhatsApp, which WhatsApp, by the way, just now hit over 2 billion users. It's not like they're going to go back and actually have issues with these massive mega deals, are they?
So the mega deals, you know, those large deals that, you know, I mean, WhatsApp, there, to be very honest, there has been a pretty consistent conversation about Facebook and WhatsApp. Should Facebook be broken up from WhatsApp? That is and seems to be on the table. So, I mean, it might happen. But what you do see, especially with, you know, and WhatsApp is, I think, a really indicative sort of company. When WhatsApp was originally acquired by Facebook, it didn't really have the kind of engineering talent that Facebook did have. And so when Facebook acquired WhatsApp and Instagram as well, that you saw a clear kind of change in the kind of quality of, you know, the services, which seems to be attributable to Facebook's engineers. So these things are, I'm not going to say these are easy things to look at. They're very difficult, intricate deals. And I think the FTC is doing a good job by looking at them. But at the same time, there's, I think, a lot of instances, what we're going to find is that, yeah, these are very reasonable mergers and acquisitions. And for the most part, I think that the FTC and the DOJ aren't going to have a whole bunch of problems with them going forward.
Just playing devil's advocate, there's been a big theory in Silicon Valley that, you know, small and scrappy and that sort of work ethos is key to innovation. And of course, you're saying that really great changes in innovation only happens kind of at scale with the resources of these giant companies. What do you say to smaller companies who feel that they don't even have a chance to compete with these giant companies?
Yeah, there is a worry, what you've hinted at, which is sometimes called the kill zone, that, you know, for example, Facebook or Google, they're, you know, quite important within, say, the ad tech industry, and they, therefore, you know, it's really hard to get ad tech dollars. Those, I personally would want to take that at a case-by-case instance. In a lot of these instances, so, for example, in the ad tech space, which is, you know, advertising technology and online advertising space, you know, we're at a 20-year mark with online advertising. So in some ways, you would expect there's not going to be as many new innovations online. But there's other places where we clearly do see that there's a lot of, you know, for example, the last year, 2019, was by volume, was the largest year for venture capital ever. So we do see venture capital and the amount of deals and the amount of money at some of the peak levels in the last 2 years, which suggests to me that there's still a lot of innovation that's going on. And there's, of course, a lot of things that, you know, Facebook and Google and Apple and Amazon aren't involved with that there's a lot of money that's being poured into. So to me, you really do need to take it an industry by industry and a case by case perspective, which is what the FTC and the DOJ do, which, again, I think is, you know, part of the process. And for me personally, I think we should trust the process.
Speaking with Will Reinhart, he's a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. So, Will, what's the bottom line? Is this going to affect companies? Is this going to affect my Amazon Prime order from Whole Foods? is it going to affect the stocks? Is it going to be business as usual? Or is this just a headache for these companies? What's going on?
I think that this is part of an overall process where, you know, a lot of policymakers are kind of rethinking what are the tools that are currently out there that the FTC and the DOJ have. I mean, for companies, you know, all of these companies that I mentioned really are under antitrust investigation. They're under, you know, questions, really big questions of competition. I don't have any sense of what's going to happen in the future. So, I mean, you could see very large fines occur. You could see calls for companies being broken up. There's a lot that's on the table with these. So I would, I think this is a really important issue. I'm not going to say that I have any, you know, I don't know what the future is going to hold, but it's definitely something that if you're involved in in it, you're invested in it, you really do need to be paying attention to these cases and the developments that are coming out of the FTC and the DOJ.
Well, thank you so much for your analysis, Will Reinhart, Senior Research Fellow at Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Thanks so much, Will. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.